Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
This show is part of the Grand Embassy Productions. Gamarjoba, and welcome to the History of Sakharvilo, Georgia. I'm your host, Roberto, and this is episode 44, The Great Debate. In today's episode, we look at the ongoing talks between the Lazai nobles. This show could not run without our wonderful Patreon members, who consistently support us month to month to make sure that we can keep the podcast going. Thank you to Marcus Aurelius, Gracie D, Ari Tena, Papa Stalin is watching, David Montgomery, Quinn Campagna, Emily Bavona, Hal the Legionnaire, Hallie Kuntz, Eric Nicholson, Mitchell Dutt, Andrew Schneider, and Audrey Neeson. You are all amazing, and thank you for all your support. Once again, thank you to all the listeners as we had another, as you can say, brief hiatus. This one was not planned, as I had the episode written and ready to record, but the issues came up when it came time for me to actually get to recording. Between my masters, which by the time this comes out will now be done, and my impending doom when it comes to student loan payments, because trust me, they're huge. So Patreon really goes to helping support that. I am trying to get episodes out as fast as I can for that. My mental health and available time have taken a huge nosedive, but I hope that this can get rectified soon, eventually. You know, at the end of the day, I'm working on it. I didn't forget that the History of Sakharvilo, Georgia is now, well, over 4 years old, and I will be releasing a dramatic reading of Medea by Euripides to mark the occasion. We'll have a few other podcasters joining us for that, so keep a lookout. Anyways, let's get started. In the last episode, the Romans had begun the siege of Onoguris. Due to the poor strategic planning by the Roman commanders Rusticus and John, the murderers of the Lazai king Gubaz II, the Romans had a devastating defeat to the Persian forces. This was because the Romans, instead of attacking the Persian reinforcements first, and then concentrating on the fortress of Onoguris, decided to send a minuscule scouting force to attack the reinforcements. The Persian reinforcements were able to squash the Roman scouting force and attack the main Roman force besieging Onoguris. This led the Romans to hastily retreat and the loss of massive amounts of Lazai land. While the Romans were losing the siege of the Persian-controlled fort of Onoguris, we shift our perspective over to the Lazai nobility and their current plans. The Lazai nobles had come from all over Lazica to a hidden location within a mountain gorge. To ensure that the Persians and Romans had no idea of what they were planning, their reason for coming together? Lazica had no singular leader, and action needed to be taken if the Lazai were going to survive the war between the two empires. The murder of King Gubaz II by the Roman commanders had formed a huge fissure in Lazai society, with the nobility no longer able to enforce policies or make contingency plans when it regarded the actions by the Romans and Persians. Loud voices echoed throughout the gorge as the Lazai nobles shouted amongst each other. Their concerns for the ongoing war became the main conversation topic. As they spoke, occasionally yelling, two camps formed amongst them. The first camp belonged to those who wanted to discuss the possibility of removing their allegiance to the Romans and make plans to ally themselves with the Persians. The other camp wanted to maintain the Roman alliance despite the recent losses and their murder of King Gubaz II, especially by the current military commanders from Rome. Agathias takes this moment to reflect on the situation, merely saying, quote, "Before long, it had degenerated into a babble of voices in which it was impossible to either tell who was speaking or what he was saying." End quote. As the noble spoke, the loud conversations turned into a continuous yell as a mix of random arguments filled the room, no longer on the topic of what needed to be done to save Lazica. A group of men came together and shouted for silence, their voices echoing off the gorge walls and piercing above the symphony of arguments. One of these men stepped forward, all eyes on him, and said that all of those who wished to speak should do so, but it had to be done in an orderly fashion, lest they fall into a discordant symphony of random noises and end the day with no solution. Those that wanted to give their opinions on which policy the Lazai nobles should pursue could do so in a coherent manner. The nobles came together in their two groups, and after a quick discussion, the pro-Persians sent their representative out first. This was a noble named Aeetes, who was named after the king of Aea in the Argonautica. Aeetes harbored an intense anger and hatred for the Romans. He was now representing the nobles who felt the same way towards their so-called allies. The thoughts in the pro-Persian group were simple. Hadn't the Romans just recently showcased their ability to do what they wanted to them? The Romans had just murdered the Lazai king in cold blood, with no remorse, and were actively losing in a war and ceding land to the Persians. And what's worse? Their so-called ally was constantly raiding and stealing sustenance from the Lazai people, stealing from the land and wealth that they had, killing them eagerly up in the mountains, all for the sake of collecting more wealth for themselves. With these thoughts in mind, Aeetes used the turmoil within the room and the recent assassination of King Gubaz II to fuel the embers that were sparking within the neutral nobility to abandon the Romans entirely. As Aeetes spoke, he pushed for the nobility to immediately move over to the Persian side, especially due to all the grievances that the Romans had piled on top of them over the last few years. Cries from the opposition shouted out, saying that it would be difficult to destroy an alliance with someone so embedded in their land, especially as they were actively defending their forts from the Persians. Aeetes was then further spurred to go into defense of the potential beneficial nature of supporting the Persians. His voice was laced with anger, and he harangued the pro-Roman group for their defiance against his views. Now, you see, Aeetes has a rather great speech in Agathias' histories, so we have Trevor from The History of Persia and American Secret Wars reading the speech for us. So, thank you, Trevor.
Aeetes, the noble supporting the Persians, Agathias, lines 391 to 310-12. If the Romans continued their injuries to words and thoughts, then we would still be effectively repaying them in kind, in which they have already committed the most monstrous act of aggression, whilst we ourselves hang around debating the issue and let the opportunity for retaliation slip through our fingers. It is no longer possible to say that they have not yet been shown to be openly engaged in active hostility against us. whereas a likely case could be made for accusing them of hostile intent. Nor, indeed, will it be necessary to produce arguments in order to establish the existence of a secret plot. But it is no longer possible, only because Gubazes, our great and noble king, has been unceremoniously disposed of like the meanest of his subjects. Gone forever is the ancient dignity of the Colchians. Henceforth, there will be no question of our aspiring to rule over others. No, we must rest content if we are allowed to avoid sinking to a much lower level than that of those who until recently were our dependents. And is it not an extraordinary state of affairs if we are going to sit around examining the question of whether we should regard the men responsible for this situation as our worst enemies or our friends? Yet it must be realized that their insolence will not confine itself to this action. If we drop the charge against them, they will not leave us alone. On the contrary, they will ill-treat us with greater impunity if we do nothing. When they find people docile, their insolence knows no bounds, and they habitually despise anyone who treats them with deference. Their emperor is utterly unscrupulous and delights in continually creating tension and instability. Hence, the suddenness with which the hideous crime was perpetrated, since it was committed at his express command and with their willing collaboration. We have all but suffered the rape of our country at their hands, though there was no prior aggression on our part, or spontaneous outbreak of hostility. While appearing to remain on the same friendly terms as before, they have committed the most unspeakable of crimes, as though seized with a sudden excess of insane cruelty and hatred and all other dark and brutal passions. How different are the ways of the Persians! Those whose friendship they have had from the start. They go out of their way to treat with unfailing kindness, reserving their anger for their enemies as long as they remain enemies. I would have wished the Colchian state were still possessed of its ancient might, needing no help from foreign powers, and completely independent in all matters that touch upon war and peace. But since whether through the passage of time or the whims of fortune, or perhaps through a combination of both, we have been reduced to the status of a subject people, I think it pays us to join the side whose attitude is the more reasonable, and whose goodwill towards their allies is not liable to fluctuate. In this way, we will get the better of our real enemies, since their past misconduct will not go unpunished, and we shall have taken the necessary steps to ensure our future safety. For that sly and ingratiating manner which enables them to injure the unsuspecting by hiding their true selves behind a facade of suavity and charm will be completely wasted on us owing to our open and uncompromising hostility towards them. Even if they should try to make war on us, they would be fighting on enemy territory, and would never be able to stand up to the combined strength of the Lazi and the Persians, or even to sustain the first shock of our arms. It is not long since they engaged a detachment of Persians with their entire army, and were at once ignominiously put to flight. They ran so fast that even now they have scarcely recovered their breath, and though they were roundly beaten in every other way, they did excel their pursuers in one respect, the speed of their flight. One might name as the obvious and immediate cause of this rout a combination of cowardice and bad judgment. And indeed, such shameful defects seem to be part and parcel of their whole makeup. But the addition of deliberate wickedness to natural depravity tipped the scales so heavily against them that their plight was made doubly disastrous, and by their foul misdeed, they forfeited the protection of Providence. Events have shown, more clearly than words can, that our joining the Persian side will be an easy and advantageous course to pursue, and we will win the approval of the deity. Nor would such a course carry with it the implication, from a human point of view, of treachery or unjust aggression on our part. Indeed, we have seen fit on many occasions in the past to abide by the terms of our alliance in spite of the insulting behavior of the Romans, because we felt that to shift one's allegiance on account of provocation, which though serious, was not altogether unbearable, was an extremely shabby thing to do. But to suffer outrageous and irredeemable harm without a murmur of protest, not to show a flicker of anger in the face of monstrous inhumanity. That, I say, is not the reaction of sensible men, but of cowards and weaklings who contrive to mask their callous indifference to the fate of their country with a specious pretense of political maturity. It is hard to imagine how any other people could become the victims of a fouler crime, or how, if they did, they could possibly overlook it. Similarly, we too must not turn a blind eye to what has happened, but must recoil in disgust from the thought of displaying indifference to the memory of our king and betraying a desire to flatter his murderers. If it were possible for him to be present here, he would be inveighing bitterly against our neglect of duty, which has enabled these guilty wretches to continue to reside in his land, instead of being expelled from it long ago. But since he will never again be present to address you, bethink yourselves of the man, and summon up a mental picture of him standing in the midst of the assembled company, pointing to the wound on his neck and his chest, and imploring his fellow countrymen to take vengeance, even at this late hour, on his enemies. Which of you, then, would brook a moment's doubt or discussion concerning the justice of Gubazi's claim to the sympathy of the Colchians? Yes, we must be on our guard, lest through the fear of being branded as deserters we allow ourselves to become participants in the crime, and throw away the chance of avenging the dead man, we will look a great deal more treacherous if our affection for him lasts no longer than this lifetime, and if when once we lose the man, we lose his memory too. When all is as it should be, it is the height of folly to change one's whole way of life. But when the reverse is the case, it pays, I think, to adapt oneself speedily to events. Reason is the criterion upon which resolution should be based, and a dogged detachment to the status quo is not always something to be praised, but only when it makes good sense. But when it is a question of giving heed to unworthy considerations and clinging tenaciously to a false position, then the man who maintains his previous stand is more blameworthy than the man who changes sides. When the Persians learn from us this decision and realize its implications, their hearts will, with good reason, warm to us, and they will fight on our behalf. For they are generous and magnanimous, and especially good at divining their neighbors' attentions. Besides, they will be gaining, without even having to ask for it, the alliance of a country of vital strategic importance and considerable military strength, which they themselves would go to great trouble and expense to possess. Make it therefore your one object to get down to business and disclose your intentions. By so doing, we should greatly enhance our prestige, while at the same time pursuing a just, honorable, and advantageous course of action.
As Aedes finished his speech, the hall erupted in applause. Aedes couldn't help but smile as he saw a vast majority of men, both neutral and pro-Roman, discuss with their fellow nobles about the possibility of switching over to the Persian side. At this rate, Lazica would end up under Persian control, all according to his plan.
If you're listening to this, you probably know that the United States of America gets involved in a lot of foreign wars. We all know the big ones: World War I, World War II, Korea, sort of, Vietnam, Iraq, Iraq again. But before and in between all that, the story a lot of us heard in school is that the US military didn't get out much. Turns out, that's kind of a blatant lie. Odds are, you've never even heard of things like the time the Marines invaded Taiwan or the Oconee Wars. I'm Trevor Cully, host of the new podcast America Secret Wars, where I am going to sit down with a guest in each episode and dive into the history of all the forgotten and overlooked times that the United States deployed military force against other nations. You can find America Secret Wars at secretwarspod.com, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy. Hello, welcome, and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest polities, and its legacy can still be felt today. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to Hanseatic merchants, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Valois Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
However, not everyone was convinced by Aetes' speech, most notably Phartazes. Vartazis thought deeply about the disadvantages that the Lazi would face by switching sides once more, especially as the Romans were already so entrenched within their lands, defending them, the most recent losses aside, from Persian conquest. The thoughts of complete destruction at the hands of the Persians and the Romans if the Lazi switched sides struck deep within his soul, and Vartazis stood up and walked to the center of the room. He asked for the nobles' attention and asked them to listen patiently and not make a final decision until they had heard all what he had to say. And of course, Agathias gives us a great speech for Vartazis, so we have Josh from Grand Dukes of the West reading the speech for us. Thank you, Josh.
That what you had heard has had a profoundly disturbing effect upon your minds is not surprising. You have, in fact, succumbed to a magnificent piece of oratory. The power of eloquence is indeed hard to combat. No man is proof against its well-aimed shafts, least of all those who have never before experienced them. But that does not mean that it cannot be countered by the prudent exercise of the faculty of reason, and by bringing critical discernment to bear on the realities of a situation. Do not, therefore, accept statements whose credibility turns out, on closer inspection, to rest not on considerations of honesty or utility, but solely on the suddenness and novelty of their appeal. Rather, you must realize that, however attractive they may appear, better options do in fact exist. Furthermore, that you were easily won over should not itself be a clear proof of the deception practiced on you. The man who is advocating a dishonest stand has greater need of impressive arguments and fine words. Thus, by effectively sugaring the pill, he quickly enlists the support of the more simple-minded. That is precisely what happened to you when Aetes contrived to lend an air of attractive novelty to his tendentious exposition. You have no conception of how thoroughly you have been hoodwinked. Yet, if nothing else, one can hardly fail to note how he started off by dragging in a completely irrelevant question. As though you were all saying that what had happened was not serious, refusing to condemn the brutal murder and concentrating all your attention on the question of whether the murderers of Gubazes were really in the wrong, he came forward and delivered a lengthy indictment of them, in which he devoted much discussion to proving what had already been established. I, for my part, regard as the vilest and most abandoned wretches whom I would gladly see put to the most horrible of deaths, not only those who struck the blows and performed the actual killing with their own hands, but all those too who had the chance to prevent it and did nothing about it. And I include those who were delighted and even those who were not particularly distressed at the crime. But the fact that I entertain such feelings does not make defection to the Persians into a sound policy. By what logic could the abandonment of principles on their part be construed as implying the necessity for a similar course of action on ours? It is hardly consistent to be angered at their treachery while ourselves incurring a similar reproach. So we must not now dwell on the unalterable and irrevocable past, lest, by deliberating in a spirit of anger, we allow our judgment to be clouded and deprive ourselves of the chance of finding a better solution. No, we must keep our heads without appearing to lose our hearts, and keep thought in advance to ensure the successful conduct of our affairs. Only fools spend their time brooding in perpetual resentment over past ills. Wise men are inured to the whims of fortune and undismayed by chance or change. They do not react to past deprivation by destroying all hope of success for the future. Aetes' pro-Persian sentiments are of long standing, and so is his desire to bring us into an alliance with Persia. This policy he is advocating by trying to scare us like so many children into believing that the Romans will not stop at what they have done, but that their effrontery will assume still more alarming proportions. Their emperor is also credited with being an arch troublemaker, and is supposed to have ordered the murder personally, the design itself having been hatched and elaborated long before its execution. While making these allegations, he praises the Persians to the skies, thinking that it will make us desert immediately and become humble petitioners of those who are, by nature, our deadliest enemies. His every remark is aimed at this objective. Right from his opening words, he goes on to great pains and great lengths to secure the realization of his pet schemes. And indeed, his uncritical harangue has the effect of confusing and frustrating the whole process of deliberation. It is the function of deliberation to take precedence, always, and to lead the way, subjecting all that remains unclear to a rigorous scrutiny. When the course of action to be pursued has been determined, then, and only then, does the desire to act upon the decisions arrived at become a necessary and relevant factor. But Aeetes has put the cart before the horse, and, before attempting to clarify the issue, has already embarked upon a decision. Yet, what is the use of deliberation if the matter has been prejudged? Bring an unbiased mind to bear, fellow Colchians, on the matter under consideration, and do not allow your views to be colored by preconceived notions and ulterior motives. We cannot force events into a pattern of our own choosing. That would be absurd. No, it behooves us to follow them step by step, subjecting them to the rational analysis of a lucid and independent mind. Such procedure would enable us to form an accurate picture of what has happened, and to discover where our true interests lie. Now, if you deliberate in this fashion, it will immediately become apparent to you that the conspiracy against Gubazi's life was not the doing of the Roman forces, nor even of all the generals, and still less of their emperor. It is already common knowledge among the Romans that Rusticus and Martin, out of envy for his good fortune, embarked on their own private piece of wickedness, not just without the cooperation of the other leaders, but even in the face of their evident displeasure. I consider it unjust as well as unprofitable to do violence to the laws of our community, which we set out to cherish, on account of the wrongdoing of one or perhaps two individuals, and to do away with the whole of our familiar pattern of life, which means so much to us, on so slender a pretext. We would also be branding ourselves as the betrayer of those who are guarding our land and imperiling their own lives so that we can live in comfort. And, most heinous of all, we would be showing contempt for the dignity of the true faith in all its outward and inward manifestations. For that is precisely what we shall seem to be doing if we join forces with the violent antagonists of the deity. If they debar us from the practice of our religion and force us to adopt theirs, then what more horrible fate could we suffer in both this world and the next? What will we gain, let us put it this way, if we win the whole of Persia and suffer the loss of our souls? Even if they were tolerant, we would certainly not be able to count on their lasting goodwill. On the contrary, it would be an illusory and insecure arrangement. Even if they were tolerant, we would certainly not be able to count on their lasting goodwill. On the contrary, it would be an illusory and insecure arrangement, a mere temporary expedient. There can be no real friendship and no lasting bond between men of different religion, not even under the stimulus of fear or of some previous act of kindness. A common religion is the one indispensable precondition for such a relationship. In its absence, even the tie of kinship suggests an affinity which is only so in name, while in reality there is no common ground whatsoever. What then do we stand to gain from going over to the Persians if even so they will remain our enemies? And we shall only succeed in making ourselves more vulnerable, in that it is more difficult to guard against the enemy from within than the enemy from without. But let us assume, for the sake of argument, that there is nothing immoral or disreputable about such a move, and that the Persians are 100% trustworthy and reliable, and will never fail to honor the terms of the future treaty. Yet, granted that this were really the case, and assuming that none of the other objections held good, we would not be in a strong enough position to act. How could we desert to a foreign power while the Romans are still in charge, and have such a huge concentration of first-rate troops on our soil, under the command of generals of no mean ability? How could we possibly avoid suffering the most savage reprisals when those who were supposed to come to our aid would be lingering in the region of Iberia and advancing at a snail's pace, whilst our avengers were occupying the whole of our country with their troops billeted in our cities? And yet, this good fellow informs us, basing his claim on recent events, that they will not even be able to sustain the first shock of our arms. Though it should be perfectly obvious that the vicissitudes of war do not conform to a set pattern, and that the failures of the moment are not doomed to be similarly unsuccessful on each and every occasion. On the contrary, victory often follows in the wake of defeat, and cures the distress it has caused. We must not, therefore, become overconfident on the grounds that habitual defeat in every engagement has become to be expected of them. For, if the sole cause of their defeat has been their failure to make the right decision, then we should let it be a warning to ourselves to be on our guard against the dangers of precipitate action. So on no account should we regard what has happened as a clear indication that we shall get the better of them. Indeed, it is only reasonable to suppose that those who have blundered in the past and have learnt from experience what to avoid will make good their previous omissions by their vigilance for the future. And if the deity is angry with them because of their heinous crime they have committed against the dead man, and that is the reason for their present plight, what need is there for us to appear on the scene to give a helping hand, as though he were not up to the task of seeing that justice is done, but required help from us? We shall certainly have reached the acme of impiety if we dishonor by our defection the beneficent providence which, even without our doing anything, fights righteously on our behalf. His speech, the figure of the dead man uttering the most unmanly complaints and beseeching his fellow countrymen to feel pity for him and pointing out his wounds. Such behavior may perhaps accord well with the portrayal of some pusillanimous and effeminate wretch, but it should never be attributed to a king, and to a king of the Lazai at that, and least of all to Gubazes. If he were present here, he would, like the pious and right-minded man he was, reproach us for entertaining such proposals, and would bid us not to be so dejected and faint-hearted, and not to resolve to run away like a gang of slaves. He would bid us rather to recover the dignity and self-reliance of Colchians and of free men, and to stand up courageously to misfortune, not allowing ourselves to be induced to do anything dishonorable or unworthy of our country's history, and, remaining true to its present obligations, secure in the knowledge that Providence will not abandon our nation. Now, if these are the sorts of sentiments that are likely to meet with the approval of the very man who is brutally murdered, is it not altogether extraordinary that we, who claim to be motivated by our affection towards him, should hold the opposing viewpoint? Indeed, I am afraid that we shall be severely punished for merely toying with the idea of following such a course. If the prospects of the intended defection were far from clear and the success of the issue could be said to hang in the balance, it would still be highly dangerous to make so momentous a decision which depends solely upon chance, though the advocates of this policy would very probably have less to fear from their impudence. But if it is shown to be a demonstrably bad policy from every conceivable point of view, then how can we fail to hate the authors of such a suggestion? Enough, then, I think, has been said to make it quite plain that we should steer clear of such a course. In conclusion, I propose that we should send a report of what has happened to the Emperor of the Romans to enable him to visit with condign punishment those most responsible for the outrage. I propose also that if he proves willing to do so, we should put an end to our dispute with the Romans and resume normal cooperation in both the civil and the military spheres. But if he should reject our petition, then we still have to consider whether it will not suit us to explore some other avenue. In this way, we would not appear to be unmindful of the dead, nor would we give the impression of acting on impulse rather than judgment in the conduct of our affairs.
The hall remained silent once Phartaxis concluded his speech. Tears had come to their eyes as Phartaxis's pro-Roman speech had stirred the true reason they had allied with the Romans to start. By siding with the Persians, they would be forced to acquiesce with Khosrow I's plans to convert the Lazai, a Christian people, to Zoroastrianism, and that would just not do. Murmurs echoed throughout the chamber as the nobles had come to a final consensus. The nobles voted as a majority that Phartaxis' plan to report King Gubaz II's murder to Justinian was the correct one, and they would reveal everything that had occurred in Lazica. In doing so, King Gubaz's name would be cleared, especially since they could all, as the Lazan nobility, vouch on their honor and the cross that King Gubaz II never dealt with the Persians after he had changed his allegiance to the Romans early on in the war. The nobles sent a letter to Justinian stating the true reason that Gubaz was murdered, which stemmed from Gubaz's disappointment and anger towards the Roman commanders Martinus and Rusticus's failures in halting the Persian advance. Gubaz is angered, partnered with his ability to have the commanders removed from their positions, and Gubaz previously having Commander Bessus removed from command, formed the core of the assassination plot within the Roman military. This led to the commanders to file false charges against Gubaz, and in doing so, unjustly remove him from the playing field. The nobles further made note to beg the emperor for his kindness, and to bring Gubaz's murderers to justice, and once that was done, to send Zath, Gubaz's younger brother, who was currently remaining within Constantinople as a hostage, to be the new king of the Lazi. Doing so would maintain the Lazi royal line, as Gubaz's children were too young to ascend the throne, and it was not their place to do so in the middle of a war. Also, sending Zath back to Lazica would maintain the Lazi allegiance, especially due to Zath's connections to the Roman capital that would easily foster better relations between the two nations. Once Justinian read the letter he had received from the Lazi nobles, he sat and deliberated everything they had laid out to him. He responded to the Lazi, agreeing to assist the Lazi nobles in the current time of political turmoil, and he would send a senator named Athanasius to conduct a full inquiry into Gubaz's murder. Athanasius arrived at the main Roman camp in Lazica and immediately sent Rusticus to the fortress in Apsaris. Once there, Rusticus would immediately be imprisoned within its walls. Rusticus's brother, John, had heard what had happened to his brother and fled from the camp to prevent his capture and imprisonment. John's escape was in vain, as the Imperial Guard managed to capture John, place him in chains, and the Imperial Guard sent him to Apsaris to be imprisoned as well. Athanasius, content with having imprisoned both John and Rusticus, met with the siblings and gave instructions to the soldiers at Apsaris that John and Rusticus would remain imprisoned until a trial could be held for them. As the last bit of snow melted into the ground, bringing forth the forgotten greenery of the Lazi lands, we shift our view over to Mocheresis, where the Persian general Nachoragan prepared vigorously for a new campaign against the Romans and to finally squash their defensive lines. The Romans, in preparation for a staunch defense of the land, placed their troops at the Nessus fortress. John and Rusticus would begin to rot in their prison cells as the start of a new campaign placed the investigation into Gubaz's murder on hold. Welcome to the spring of 556. To connect with us, feel free to find us on social media under @history_Georgia, on our website which is czarpower.com, on Facebook at The History of Sacramento, Georgia, or just anywhere else. You know, we're the history of Georgia. It's great. Our intro music is Bindi Speria Sopeli by Zidashi. Now, as you guys heard earlier, I am struggling with student loans, but I am trying to continue getting podcast content out to you. So if you want to make my life a bit easier, help buy some books, or just help me get through these horrible payments that I'm trying to get through, feel free to subscribe to our Patreon. We have content for both Czar Power and the History of Sacramento, Georgia. We have a bunch of episodes on there. We also have a Ko-fi or a PayPal you can subscribe to. The links are in the episode description. If you would prefer donating something a bit more tangible, we can also, you know, take some free books from you as well. But the best way to help us if you're not able to pay some money is to give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast host. Because those 5-star reviews really help us get, you know, the word out there. And, you know, I want people to learn more about Georgia. So, madlaba the nakfamdis, and thank you for listening to The History of Sacramento, Georgia. See you next time.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.